This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
I worked as hard as I could, but don't deny the value of luck. And I was miserable. I was clinically depressed. The more life gave me, the more I hated life. And the same applies to your brain. Huh? You want to be happy, learn to do something that makes you. And I cried my head off. And I decided this was it. I'm not going to be that person anymore.
Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of The Mentes. My name is Diego Barrazas, and today I have a really special guest. His name is Mo Gauda. You might know him as the author of the book Solve for Happy, Engineering Your Path to Joy, but he's also the host of a podcast called Slow Mo, which I recommend you a lot. In this episode, we do talk about happiness, but we also talk about his life, his trajectory, and how did he make it to where he is right now. So I hope you enjoy it. Let me know what you think. Well, Mo, thank you for being in The Mentes. It's an honor to have you here, and it's a pleasure. I've read your book, I've listened to your talks, and I'm a great admirer of your work, and I really subscribe to the way you think. It's something I just learned like 2 years ago that I started on this path of, instead of trying to control and trying to be happy, just being in this sense of calm and serenity that also you talk about in your book, about how we confuse sometimes having fun with being happy. And it has been an eye-opening thing to understand.
You're one of those fun, party guys, are you?
not party guy, but I used to be like, oh, I need to watch a movie, or I want to do this, or I want to do that, to think like that I was happy. Now I understand that it's not the addition of things that make you happy, but it's even in sometimes a subtraction of things. Now, instead of trying to confuse.
Agree.
So thank you for that. And
thank you, by the way. I mean, I'm a huge fan of your work, a huge fan of Latin America, and the opportunity doesn't come often to speak to people, widely. I used to come and visit many times a year, but now we're all locked down, and so this is a very good way to talk to people about happiness at this time.
Thank you. And I want to start with something that I haven't heard you talk about a lot. They always invite you and talk about happiness and do this deconstruct how to be happy and the happiness formula. But what I want to talk about right now is a little bit of your background. And how did you end up where you are right now? And not only speaking and advocating for happiness, but how did you get to be in one of the most desired places for innovators and people in technology? That was, for example, Google X, and doing this moonshot project. And before that, how did you start it? And when did you understand that this was what you were good at? If you know what I'm trying to say.
I know what you're trying to say. I think the answer is I got lucky. Is that
really
the answer you're looking for, is it?
No, it's whatever answer, it's okay. But do you believe in luck?
Oh, totally. I believe in luck, but I believe in an interesting definition of luck. We can come back and talk about this. I'll say openly, I have been... You know, I'm Egyptian, born and raised in Egypt. I went to public school, public university in Egypt. So my lifetime dream was that maybe sometime in my future, I'd become sales manager of IBM where I started, right? IBM in Egypt where I started. And then, you know, I went a very, very, very long path down my career. I definitely think being chief business officer of Google X is probably the best job on the planet. Like you can't have a better job than that, right? You know, I used to joke at the time when I was at Google X that Larry Page, our CEO of Google at the time, you know, my only worry is that he would want my job, right? Because my job my job was nicer than his. And in an interesting way, It is, I definitely believe there are three reasons why I ended up in that place. And none of them is what people always talk to you about. It's, you know, I worked hard, or I'm, you know, I'm this guy, I'm smart. No. The truth is I was lucky. I did things that I love, and I did things that were good for our planet. Okay. And most people don't understand that, but I'll go through them very quickly if you'll let
me. Yes, please. Take your time.
Okay. Starting from the last one, and you'll be amazed. You know, in where I come from, in our Islamic background, we have a saying that if you chase life, life runs away from you as fast as it can. Okay. Yeah. But if you help life, life conspires to help you. Okay. And truly and honestly, you know, I was very, very blessed at a very young age with very good friends. And then I got married to my college sweetheart, who's an absolute angel. And, you know, even though we're no longer together, we're still best friends. We stayed together for 28 years. And she shaped me in so many ways around the idea of, you can call it spirituality, you can call it karma, but the idea that you actually don't have to do things just for your own selfish gains. That sometimes when you do things for life, okay, life itself goes like, good guy, you're trying to help me out, I'll help you out, okay? And I had that many, many times in my career. I had very clear moments, you know, when you get that aha feeling of, oh, that actually works. When I do well, life helps me, life pushes me forward. And I think the idea of doing well is not a stranger to any of us. As a matter of fact, I always say it's not difficult to do the right thing. It's just difficult to know what the right thing is. And to try and know what the right thing is requires you to have, how do I say, you know, it requires you to have a very clear commitment to search inside yourself, if you want, to really be open to changing your mentality, to be open to changing your conditioning, what you were told as a child was right and wrong. And we can talk about this for hours if you want. The second thing is, I actually got lucky. I mean, it's not that I didn't work hard, okay? I worked hard. Every time I was given the opportunity, I worked as hard as I could. I worked as smart as I could. But don't deny the value of luck. I mean, just take Google. I joined Google at a time when I was the head of emerging markets for the communications sector at Microsoft. And at the time...
How old were you?
I was 40 when I joined Google, 2017, January is when I joined. And... 2007. And the idea is, I had already achieved quite a lot. Corporate world was really not that interesting, often political, and I chose to never be political because I always chose to do the right thing. And as a result, I was really contemplating retiring. And one of my very close friends and very strong allies was the head of Eastern Europe at the time, a German gentleman, who had just had a baby, okay? And so he was traveling across Eastern Europe. It was, you know, not his priority. And he came to me and he said, maybe, you know, it's time for me to try and do something more local. And I knew the country manager of Germany reasonably well. So I picked up the phone. I said, hey, you know, this gentleman, I really recommend him. He's an amazing guy. And you guys should take him as sales manager for Germany. And so it happened. Okay, and the country manager of Germany, instead of telling him directly, called me and said, you probably should tell him, you know, you started this whole conversation. So I remember vividly, I was sitting with him in Rhodes, you know, having coffee, escaping from one of those conferences that are boring like hell. And we're sitting outside, we're chatting, and I told him, hey, Florian, congratulations, you got the job, right? And he was so happy, he picked up the phone to call his wife and say, I'm going to stop traveling. She was very happy. You know, everything was wonderful. He puts the phone down and the phone rings and it's a headhunter, okay, approaching him to join Google. And he basically, you know, I don't know who's the on in the other side, but he's like, yeah. No, I'm not interested. I just got exactly what I want, right? Wow. But then he pauses for a second and he says, but I know the exact right person for the job. And he hands the phone over to me. And I'm like, wow. Who is this? And he goes like, just talk to her. Right. So I talk to her. Agnieszka is now still one of my best friends. And she says, you know, I have this job for you. It's one of the leading internet players in the world. And I said, no, I'm not interested. I think I'm done with corporate America. And she said, no, but this is the largest internet player on earth. And I was like, yeah, but I'm done. I'm really grateful. And she said, and I quote, so just so that you know how lucky I am. She said, are you stupid? I'm telling you. I swear. And she's still, you know, she's still one of my best friends because she did that to me. Huh? Uh-huh. She said, are you stupid? I'm talking about Google. And
they,
said,
they normally yeah. don't say, right?
They're they normally don't uh-huh. say the name, right? Uh-huh. And so she said, you know, give me a day, go to London, meet them. And if you don't like it, then go ahead with your life, but don't pass on that opportunity. So by total coincidence, I was actually going to London the next Thursday. This was on a Monday. And I said, I'm going to be in London for 6 hours on Thursday. Can you arrange the meetings? Right? So she arranged the meetings. Right. And you tell me if this is not luck. Right. I mean, I could tell you I'm the smartest person on earth and I searched for all of those opportunities. And when the opportunities came, I grabbed them. I'd be lying. Like I seriously
you
said no
almost
three times.
Dismissed. Yeah. Yeah. You almost
yeah. Right. Right. So this is the second thing. Luck is really interesting. Luck helps you when you help it. And we can talk about luck at length if you want. I have a very clear definition for it. But without luck, we don't go very far, okay? And our ego and arrogance telling us that we are the ones that make everything is stupid. So my message is open your eyes to luck because when it shows up, you should grab it, right? That's number two. And number three...
Before you go to number three, I have a question about the second one and I want to do like a double click on that one. I mean... One thing is for you to have had that opportunity and that person to come and tell you like, hey, there's this job opportunity. You should take it. Don't be stupid. But what did you have to do to be able to, like, for example, if I'm calling a friend and I want to give him a job, you know, like I'm a recruiter and he says, no, talk to this other person. I might not, you know, like push too hard to that, or I don't know the other person, you know what I'm trying to say? I don't know that person. I don't know how good they are on what they are doing. So why would she, like, what did you do to be in a position that when someone told them like, hey, talk to Mo, she would be like, okay, this guy might be good for the job. You know what I'm trying to say?
I was always very good at what I did, actually because of number three, which mm-hmm. we'll come back to in a bit, but that's not good enough. So understand this. I was good for mm-hmm. the job. They wanted someone to run emerging markets for Google. I ran the comm sector in emerging markets for Microsoft. I understood emerging markets really, really well. And I understood the telecom sector and the internet, which were really my customers, really, really well. I understood advertising and the media really, really well. I was a very good fit for the job. And I worked hard. I worked my butt off mm-hmm. all my life. Okay. But that doesn't mean that I was the only qualified person for that job. And that's what we forget when we think that we did it. Because I can guarantee you there must have been 10,000 other people in tech in Europe, in emerging markets, who knew this as good as I did. Okay. And the fact that the call came to me and not to them is just something you can never plan. Okay. It's not something you can actually design as a path of your life. You understand? And I think that's also true. The other truth, of course, is it's luck alone is not enough, because luck alone will give you something that has a lot of value to it. And it's now up to you to turn it into equity. Okay. To turn it into something that is valuable. Now, in my view, what really worked very well for me and a big part of what I now focus on as part of my work on happiness is I've actually never in my life done a job I didn't like. Which sounds counterintuitive, because normally people will say, hey, you know, when there is a will, there is a way. When you're targeting something, you should take a little bit of pain to get there. And, you know, we all have to make sacrifices. Absolute crap. Okay. I promise you, it's absolute crap, right? For the simple reason that we perform our best when we are loving what we do,
right?
You know, but by definition, ask yourself, are you better with a partner that you're not really sure about, or are you better when you're crazy about her or about him, right? Are you better with going out with friends that you really don't enjoy, or are you better going out with friends that are really, you love them, you really enjoy their company? Are you better reading books that you dislike the topic of, or are you better reading books that you love? Are you better listening to podcasts about things that you don't enjoy, or podcasts about things that matter to you? And the truth is, we are geared as humans, and I teach that a lot when I speak about happiness, we are geared for to be tuned for optimal performance, right? And your optimal performance, just like when you're healthy, you perform better than when you're sick, right? And that is why we are wired, if you catch a tiny bit of a flu, to say, oops, something is wrong, I have an itchy throat, you know, I'm going to take vitamin C and rest a little. You're programmed to do this because it's your ultimate optimum mode of performance and survival, right? Similarly, we are wired to do so much better when we're happier, as per my definition of happiness, not out there in the world surfing and wasting, you know, time and enjoying and having fun only. These are important too, but happy in terms of, I like this, I am okay with this, I can spend a lot of time doing this, right? And when we get into those places, it's scientifically proven with surveys, people who are happy are 12% more productive than those who are not. But you don't need a survey to prove that to you, because people who are happy are more committed to what they do. They report less absent leave. They make their colleagues and their clients and their partners happy. So those people want to work with them, want to give them business, want to make them successful. They don't waste brain cycles on complaining and focusing on things that are negative. They're just focused on the positive and focused on trying to make things better. So by definition, if you choose something that you love, you're going to do it better. Okay. And that made a massive difference to my life. And don't think of me too idealistically. Sometimes I did jobs that I didn't like, but no longer than 6 months. And I made the choice to leave in what was no longer than a month. So, you know, for example, while I was at Google, I was head of emerging markets, you know, for the first 7 years. And in those 7 years, I opened half of Google's businesses worldwide. And, you know, it was an incredible experience, you know, so rewarding to bring Google to Bangladesh and have it in Bengali and help the world in that way. And it was wonderful in every way. But then it became boring, right? They wanted me to push my people to use CRM and enter data in stupid spreadsheets all the time and report and you know, I can do that. I ran businesses like of that magnitude many times in my life, but it's boring. I don't like it. Okay. And so I simply walked to my boss around a couple of arguments later, you know, when he was constantly insisting that we use CRM and I was constantly insisting it was a waste of time. You know, we had a conversation and I said, in that case, get someone who loves CRM. I'm going to go look for something else, right? Which is absolutely stupid. Because when you really think about it, I'm the head of half of Google. Like, you know, that's something quite big. And within 6 months, I come across Google X. Simply with a complete stroke of luck again. Just simply because I was opening my eyes now that I need to move. I need to go somewhere else. And so the minute someone said about something about Google X and I liked it, I went and camped there, you know, in Google. Yeah, seriously, in Google, we had that concept of 20% time. You can do 20% of your time doing something that you like. And so, I showed up. And because of my very senior Google ID, I could open every door in Google. And so it's literally on a Monday morning, they found this new guy walking in Google X. And, you know, I was talking to everyone.
They asked, like, what are you doing here? Or was it like...
I know a lot of people. I mean, I've been reasonably around Google for a long time. And so they were like, what are you doing here? And I was like, I'm going to work with you guys. And that's it. And, you know, a few months later, we ended up with me being the chief business officer.
Okay, I haven't forgot about the third thing, but first, I also want to take on that. For example, in that case, you just went there and said, like, hey, I'm going to start working with you guys, etc. How did you earn their respect? I mean, I know you were already like a senior in that place, but many of the times, I suppose, younger guys might be like, hey, who's this guy? He doesn't know about innovation or whatever, you know, like he's in charge of a business part of the operation. Why is he coming here? And then why did he become the chief officer? Like, how do you earn their respect or their admiration? And how do you make it, for example, for your boss in this case to say, okay, we're going to make you the leader here. Like, how does that happen? And I'm asking you because many of our listeners might have the same question on their jobs, right? Like, how can I get involved in another area and not only force my way in, but be wanted here?
Do you know the concept, the Chinese concept that's known as the death by a thousand cuts?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you understand this, you understand, and most of us go through stages of our careers. Now, we start with focusing on being individual contributors. You know, you want to do things as an individual contributor. You want to, you know, have your own performance recognized and so on. There is a point in your career, which the earlier the better, where you recognize that life is all about people and connections. Okay? That as an individual, you can only go, you know, they say if you want to go fast, go alone, but if you want to go far, yeah, go together, right? And so I had a very simple approach of, I understood in my heart that I wasn't the smartest person around, okay? And I understood in my heart that most people, no one wakes up in the morning and says, okay, I'm going to annoy a few people today, okay? Right, it's like, no, that's not the objective of anyone. People annoy each other because they differ in their value system. And if you respect that you're not the smartest person around and that you don't have to judge everyone, you start to learn to never burn a bridge.
Okay?
And when you never burn a bridge, even with people that you disagree, you can take a very assertive position, but without burning bridges, it always pays back eventually. So, you know, for example, when I started my career, I started in IBM. In IBM Egypt, I worked for the government sector and, you know, I kept good relationships. I was building trust. I was delivering what was expecting from me, whether in the company or to my clients and so on. By maybe my mid-30s and mid-40s, most of my clients became ministers and prime ministers. Most of my customers, you know, which were CTOs or whatever at the time, became CEOs of the largest companies in Egypt, right? And they all had that trust with me, right? Similarly, with every client everywhere in the world, there was a time when, you know, I was quite welcome in China, you know, working with the Chinese government, for example, even though, you know, Google at the time wasn't really very well connected in China, if you want. Why? Because I never burn a bridge. I have my own personal connection. And the story with Google X is at the time we had vice president's meeting, something, I think it was called the Golden Circle or something like that. So it was Larry Page and a few, you know, very select, you know, updates on what Google is doing. And, you know, one of them got on stage and spoke about Project Loon, which was providing the internet from balloons, which is totally what I love to do, right? I mean, internet, helping emerging markets. I was highly qualified for this. So anyway, as he comes down from the stage, his boss, Astro at the time, comes to say, well done. And, you know, this is an amazing presentation. And I show up and I go like, I'm going to work with you on this. And they go like, yes, and you are. And I said, I'm Mo, and I do this and that, and this is my background. And at the time, their head of strategy, the head of strategy for Google X at the time, a wonderful lady that eventually became the CTO of Barack Obama, you know, shows up and instead of telling them, well done, this is an amazing presentation, hugs me and says, Mo, hi, how are you? Right. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God, hi, so good to see you. And she basically looks at them, doesn't know that I'm telling them I'm going to be working with them, looks at them and says, He's the best person in Google. Okay. And I'm like, that's the intro, right? And again, think of luck. Huh? She shows up at the right time to, you know, me and her worked previously in Africa to make a big difference to Africa and bring the internet to Africa. And, you know, it wasn't her job at the time, but it was something she was passionate about. And I welcomed her completely and respected her and loved, you know, working with her. And we were always happy and friendly and so on and so forth. Those are the things that matter. You know, when creating enemies is a good way to move fast.
Yeah.
Okay. Creating friends is a very, very, very good way to relieve yourself from constantly looking over your shoulders and protecting yourself from the death of a thousand cuts. But at the same time, it's also friends will always show up. Okay, there will be a point in time where you'll pick up the phone and say, you know, John, Jonathan, Jerry, whoever, hey guys, can you help me out here? I need to know something about this or whatever. Okay. And it's all about people, and it's not about people in a selfish way. It's about people in a respectful way, in a loving way, if you want. Because if you pretend that you like people because you
people
need something
know.
From them,
figure
it out.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I love that, Mo. Before going forward with this, I want to go back to the third thing you said that made you be where you are today. You said luck. You said being good with trying to find the good things for the world and the planet. And the third thing was?
Yeah. And the third is never do anything you don't love. Okay. If you don't love your job today, don't go crazy and quit. Okay. But make it your intention to find the job that you like. Okay. It may take you 6 months. It may take you a year because of COVID-19, but now you're on track. Okay. And when you interview for the next job, don't interview for something that will pay you $100 more. Interview for something that will make you 10% happier. Okay. And if you're constantly looking for what you love to do, you're eventually going to end up in a place, you know, that makes you successful. Success leads to happiness. You know, happiness leads to success. It's not success that leads to happiness. And I would openly say that applies to everything. Huh? You know, if you're with a partner and you're with them because, yeah, it's okay, right? And, you know, maybe I don't want to go dating again. And, you know, stability is good. And, right? If you're not totally excited about your life every morning, change it. Okay? Life is a world we live in total abundance. Right. And the idea is if you believe in abundance, life treats you with abundance. If you believe that I hold on to what I have and I am afraid and I, you know, have to sacrifice. Yeah
it's kind of like the theory about givers and takers, right? That takers end up not being as well as people who give. Adam Grant was talking about that, right?
Totally.
And okay.
So totally. Yeah. I don't know what's the word for it in English. In Arabic, it's thawab. In Eastern religions, it's karma. But truly, you know, giving is the shortest path to receiving. And again, you know, just be out there believing that you will never, never need. Okay. Give because there is so much to come back to you. And I may sound like a spiritual guru or whatever. I'm not. I'm an engineer. I'm
That's what I love, because you're really practical. But at the same time, you're talking about.
And you can measure it. You can measure those things. Right? You know, basically, your life is like water, right? You can keep it around you and hold on to it, but then it becomes stale. It smells like a swamp, right? Or you can let it run like a river. If things come to you and then go out from you and go to others and make others happy, and then, you know, other things will come to fill its place like water. It will be running and fresh and pure. And there will be more of it because you're leaving the space for more to come into your life. The challenge we have with life is we get comfortable. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, I like this and I don't want to let it go because I like it, right? Not knowing that when you let it go, you get another experience. Sometimes better, sometimes worse. Doesn't matter. It's another experience because life is what you make of it, if you know what I mean. Huh? I mean, I've been homeless partially for the last I'd probably say 5-6 years since my wonderful ex-wife and I separated. I move from place to place. I rarely ever stayed in a place more than 5 to 6 months. Okay. And yeah, I miss having my coffee machine.
Why do you decide not to stay on one place?
Many reasons. You know, when they say home is where the heart is. I mean, I loved many other partners in my life after my ex, but to overcome the home that we built together and find another home was not easy. Okay. And so no place really felt like home, if you want, other than perhaps a short experience with a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful woman in the UK when I was there last time. You know, otherwise it always felt transient, if you want. Okay. And this is one thing. The other thing is every part of life, at least my view of it, is to be experienced. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are stages of our life where, I don't know how to say it, you sort of believe that this is it. But then, you know, when you don't, you realize there is so much more. There is so much more. And so, you know, I wrote Solve for Happy when I lost my wonderful son, Ali left at a time where I was hard in the work of Google X, you know, and an executive who has that lifestyle, if you want. And then I wrote Solve for Happy to honor him and to spread his message. And I started to travel the world to spread that message. I mean, there, you know, the first year when my book was published, it was I traveled around the world, around the globe, full circle, 8.7 times. And then the second year I did 8.9 times. And then the third year I did 7.8 times. And I'm so grateful for COVID-19 that I'm not doing that anymore, by the way. But I was driven by a mission, and that mission, for a very long time, I had reduced my entire life to two suitcases, one small one that I can take with me on the flight and one that I check in. The one that I checked in was specifically between 22.8 kilograms and 23.2 kilograms. The difference was protein bars. And that's because they wouldn't allow me to check it in if it's higher or lower. And so, and part of that experience was that I needed to count the 14 t-shirts that I can take with me everywhere. If I wanted to buy a new t-shirt, I had to give one away. And that had so much joy to it, Diego. Very different kind of joy to the joy I had when I had 16 cars in my garage, mm-hmm. right? Now I had 14 t-shirts, and that is it. And so you start to live a very different flavor, which is there is not going to be a t-shirt allowed in my life unless there is a massive love story between me and that t-shirt, because it takes, you know, 7% of my t-shirt quota. So that's quite serious. And when you start to see it this way, and I say that with tremendous love, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Mexico. I love Mexico City. I love lots of parts of Mexico, the non-touristic parts. I am crazy about Colombia. Like, I totally drool in love with the people of Colombia, with the positivity, with the family traditions, with the, you know, the language, the fun, the whole thing, right? I love, Bali. I love Dubai. I love Egypt. I love Canada, where I am right now. I loved the UK when I stayed there. But none of them, to me, felt like home. None of them yet. I mean, I'm still seriously considering Colombia, to be quite honest. But none of them really felt like this is it.
Okay.
This is where I should be. And because I had that mission rolling in my blood, I was just moving. The freedom that you get with moving is quite something. It's quite something. The freedom not of seeing places. By the way, I'm not the touristic guy, but the freedom of no attachment. Yeah. This is, by the way, one of the highest spiritual targets in spiritual teachings like Buddhism or Hinduism and Sufism and so on. It's that idea of no clinging, that nothing, you don't hold on to anything. is massive. It's total
freedom. Yeah, you have no weight, right? Like a less heavy life, if you want to call it that. And do you think you're ever going to find home again? Like, but or what would it take to find something that you can call home again?
So I'm not homeless. Let's call it I'm multi-homed. Okay. So I'm now in Canada, in Montreal, and my daughter lives here, and my daughter is a big part of my heart. And, you know, of course, Canada, you know, Montreal, because of her, feels like home. And I'm in this incredibly beautiful Airbnb that's, you know, sadly, because of COVID-19, is dirt cheap. Okay. And, you know, I wish I would pay the host a little more, because it's wonderful, really, really a wonderful place. But it's such a beautiful experience. Okay. Now I'm leaving end of the month, and I'm going to Dubai, and I'm going to look for another place. And to be in such a beautiful place, it's 250 years old, you know, stone and wooden ceilings, and so much soul in it. And in my heart, I'm completely unattached. I felt it. It was my home. It is my home. It will forever be my home. But I don't have to be in it.
You're not clinging to it. That's what happens to me, for example, with my wedding ring, my wedding band. We had a discussion, my wife and I, because I told her
be careful.
But what we were talking about was, for example, she told me, like, if I lost my ring, like, she would be devastated, right? Like, her ring. And in my way of being, it was like, I could lose it or whatever other present I have. And I love it while I have it. And if it's lost, I won't be like, oh my God, I mean, like, I can find a new, like, you can give me a new ring and I will love it as much as I did the last one. But I'm not worried about losing things, because the object is not what I love. It's like spot the, on. What it represents and the feeling and right now, but
And that's so interesting, because what it represents remains without the object.
Exactly. That's I was talking with Alejandra Llamas. I don't know if you know her. She's an author. And we were talking about death, right? About the death of loved ones. And what she was talking about, and it has to do with what we're talking about right now, she said that, like, people kind of feel bad sometimes because they lost this loved one, because they think they won't love him. What can't love them anymore, but the thing is, you can still love you're gonna miss the physical part of them, but you can still have the same amount of love for someone and without them being there. I bet totally. You have a lot to talk about totally. That.
Of course. I mean, I can talk about the love of Ali for hours, and I can actually talk about how life somehow, God, as I believe. In God, you know, has replaced his God and his love and added so much love to my life. But on that note, before we go there, you know, I was talking on my podcast on Slow Mo to Matthew Ricard. I don't know if you know Matthew. Matthew is, he's known as the world's happiest man. He's a French PhD in cellular genetics that ended up at age 29, leaving life behind and going to become a monk. And he was one of the most renowned monks in Tibetan Buddhism because of several studies on his brain that actually showed how his brain morphed as a result of constant meditation. And I was talking to Matthew at a time when I'm actually really contemplating how much of a monk lifestyle I want in my life. And I asked him, and I said, Matthew, why do you do that? Like, why do you give up on a life, French, you know, stylish, born to a French philosopher and a French artist, high society in France? And, you know, why do you give up on that? And he said, well, life is designed so that you give up on something, right? Most of us end up giving up on what life decides to force us to give up on. I decided to choose. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was asking him very openly. I was saying, you know, why do monks have to give up on romance? I mean, it's such a wonderful thing to have in your life, to have a romantic partner and that energy and wonderful experience. And he said, well, which woman would accept for me to go and spend 3 years next to my teacher or 4 years in a solitary,
retreat?
Yeah, right. And, you know, and I understand there is so much joy in having someone next to you, but I chose the joy of ascending on my path to enlightenment. And by the way, even if she had accepted it, would it have been fair of me to treat her that way? And somehow, when you really think about those choices, do I choose to have a stationary place which has a certain joy to it? I mean, I spent around 8 months in London last year, where I had my own coffee machine, and you know, that amazing romantic relationship between you and the same, right? It's like you wake up every morning, hi, honey, what are you going to make for me today? And then it makes you that perfect coffee, right? And you go like, you know, this is something to cling on to, right? And, you know, and somehow you had that joy, or the joy of really, I mean, I have so many friends, so many people that I love. Luckily, so many people that love me in so many places around the world. If I get to Mexico City tomorrow, I'll probably be spending, I mean, I don't know if you guys are still locked down. I doubt that you anyway conformed. You know. Yeah. You know, right? If I go to Colombia tomorrow, I'll probably have like 200 friends. And, you know, if I go to Mexico tomorrow, I'll probably have 200 friends. And, you know, it's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. And it's, by the way, it's not about abundance in terms of like, 200 friends is better than one. Okay. One friend is more than enough. But the idea of leaving one thing for another, these are the choices we make. Yeah. The choice of, do I want my coffee machine, or do I want all of that love everywhere in the world? And, you know, I haven't made up my mind, to be honest. What would make me, you know, what would make me find a home? I don't know. When I find it, I'll text you and say.
Yeah, but I guess the important thing about these parties. The ability to choose, right? Or I mean, the consciousness of you could choose what to leave behind and what to put on hold instead of just doing whatever life gives you, right? Like, you know, like not knowing and going on an automatic path, and suddenly you are somewhere you didn't wish to be or you didn't want to be.
Yeah, I mean, so look, it's easier said than done, huh? Because we're conditioned at a very young age to believe in things that become such a big part of us that it's hard to question them. I had, you know, since I wrote Solve for Happy, I started to teach a lot. I mean, I taught maybe on average 60 to 80,000 people a year, right? And it was wonderful in every way, but sometimes it was big groups of 10,000 people, and sometimes it was, you know, just a few. I once had a retreat with 14 very high net worth individuals, which, by the way, are always very unhappy. You know, a group from Belgium, and Northern Europe is known for the love of debate. If you tell them the wall behind you is white, they'll say, no, hold on. Let's examine that. It's not entirely white. There are shades of gray on it, and it's a little yellowish. It's off-white. Is that cream or is that, right? And, and they'll debate, okay? So we were on, it was a 3 days retreat. I was chill like mad. I'm always chill in an interesting way, but I was even more chill. So by 4 hours into day one, I was on the second line of my first slide.
Ugh.
Okay. And the rest of the 4 hours was debate between them. They didn't even take a break. Okay. So I would say hello, and they would start to debate. Should it be hello? Should it be hi? Should it be Gutenberg? What, right? And I smiled. And I then after 4 hours, I said, you guys realize I'm just on the second line of my first slide. Are you comfortable with that? And they said, yeah, but we had a very good conversation. And I said, sure, you guys really like to debate. Why do you like to debate so much? And they said, because it's the way to find the truth. And I said, hallelujah, absolutely. We all want to find the truth. Have you ever debated anything your brain told you? And they said, what? And I said, have you ever? Because you guys debated every sentence that any other brain said in this conversation. So if it wasn't you saying it, you debated it. Have you ever debated anything your brain, your own brain told you? And they said, no. And I said, so how do you know if it's true?
Oh.
Right? And that is the absolute truth, Diego. That's the absolute truth. Is, you know, I was born in the Middle East. In, you know, you may find that really, really, really shocking, huh? But where I come from, a woman grows to believe that wearing a conservative dress, okay, is the way to be loved and accepted and respected in society. You travel to Rio de Janeiro on the Copacabana beach, okay, a woman is raised to believe that a G-string is the way to be loved and respected and appreciated in life, that her beauty matters and that it's absolutely okay to show it. As a matter of fact, it's good to show it, okay? Is one of them right and the other wrong?
No.
Right? Is one of them better and the other worse? No. Right? It's the way they were conditioned as they grew up in that society. If you took that Saudi woman and had her raised by a Brazilian family in Rio de Janeiro, G-string it will be. Right? And so the idea here is the following. Have we ever debated what our own brains told us? And I have been on that quest, believe it or not, since age 29. It's the longest quest of my life.
Why at 29? Okay? What happened for you to start thinking about that?
29 was the time when everything I did succeeded massively. I was a money printing machine. I was incredibly successful. I had married Nibel, my college sweetheart, which is, you know, the most amazing woman on the planet. Beautiful, sexy, wise, spiritual, loving, kind, everything you can dream of. She gave me two amazing kids. I had, you know, at age 29, I was a director in a consumer's goods company, which paid me really well. But on top of that, I traded in the stock market with my math skills. I swear to you, I printed money on demand. When I needed money, I would go trade in the market for a couple of hours, make the money I need, and that was it, right? The swimming pool, the cars, the villa, everything you think you dream of. And I was miserable. I was clinically depressed, right? The more life gave me, the more I hated life. It was horrible. Okay. And the thing that kills you is when you have money, you throw money at the problem. So you go on vacations and you buy expensive suits and, you know, you buy a car and then it doesn't make you happy. You buy another car. And it's stupid. And you eventually you start to lose hope. You start to go like, this is it. This happiness thing is never going to happen again.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember vividly one day, my wonderful daughter. So I had Ali, my late son. Ali was a tiny little Zen monk, okay? Like so peaceful, so wise, little Yoda since the day he was born, right? And I had Aya. Aya was sunshine. She was life itself, okay? Fun, funny, playful, outgoing, you know, active, amazing, amazing bundle of life. And I remember vividly, you know, with my crazy executive money-making, you know, mind and the image you see, you know, cross-armed and, you know, frowning and, you know, stupid. But we believe that stuff. And you read Harvard Business Review and you watch, you know, you look at Fortune magazine.
Everyone looks like that.
This is the image you want. Yeah. This, if you don't do this, you're not going to succeed in life, right? And so it was a Saturday, I'm working on something and my daughter comes into the room after she wakes up. She jumps up and down and says, "Papi, we're going to this place today." And I'm like, "Can we please be serious?" She was 5. What serious? Like, what stupid? What are you stupid, man? Like, where did you get that from, right? And I could see her heart break with my own eyes. I could see her heart break. I could see her face change. I could see her tears coming down. And I freaking hated me. Like, I was like, I don't like this person. And I'm, you know, I'm very masculine in my appearance and in my behaviors, but I'm also quite emotional and kind and tender inside, if you want. And, you know, I sometimes say I'm 58% feminine. But anyway, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with your gender or your sexuality or whatever. The feminine and masculine are qualities, you know. And so so I closed my door after she left and I cried my head off how I could break my daughter's heart that way, okay? And I decided this was it. I'm not going to be that person anymore. And just like I
achieved every quota, every target I took in my life I achieved, I was going to give myself a target to turn my unhappiness, grumpiness, annoyingness, control freakishness around. Okay. And that required a lot of self-examination. In my theory, in my work on Soul for Happy, your happiness is found inside you. You're born happy. It's just that you pile stuff on it. You pile stuff that makes you unhappy. Okay. And that stuff is not from within you. It came from outside you. And so if you start to examine what made you unhappy, bit by bit, you'll be able to remove them. Every time you remove something, what's left behind is happier. Okay. And so there was a ton of self-examination, the conditioning of being a Middle Eastern, the conditioning of being a man, the conditioning of being, you know, an executive, the conditioning of being a software engineer, the conditioning of being a mathematician, and the condition of religion, the conditioning of religion. I'm still very religious, but not the way I was conditioned to be religious. Yeah. You know what I mean? And all of that takes a lot of examination. My view of myself, my view of women, my view of kids, my view of success. What is success? That even that definition is planted.
But how can someone avoid feeling lost when peeling all of this? You know, like if it was an onion, right? That you peel all of the surface off, or the conditioning, or did you feel lost when you did that? Because
of course you do. Of course you do. Being lost is the only way to be found. Mm-hmm. Do you understand that? Until you're lost, you're never going to be found. And we worry, we feel anxious about being lost. But the truth is, for those explorers, they enjoy, they actually seek being lost. You know, have you ever walked out in a natural place and said, I'm just going to walk aimlessly for an hour, right? Being lost, this is what exploring is all about. Now, the trick is, have you ever debated anything your brain told you? Mm-hmm. And that's really the trick. How do you do it? You sit down and you go like, a man should be like that. This is what they teach you in the Middle East. And in Latin America, you guys are as macho, as macho as we are, right? And and then you sit down and you say, okay, so let's assume that this is right for a minute. Do I want to be like that? Forget what they told me. Do I want to be like that? Am I actually like that? Did I enjoy it when I was like that? Were there other moments in my life where I wasn't like that I enjoyed? Did my wife enjoy me being like that? Okay. When I was not married anymore, was that what women seeked in me? Mm-hmm. Forget women. Was that when I felt, how if you play music, if you're as old as I am, you used to have tuning forks, to tune your guitar, you would hit a fork and it would make the sound of E. And then you would tune your guitar to that sound. That fork would always make the sound of E. Why? Because that's its natural resonance, right? It's built to feel that way. So, what is my natural resonance? Is my natural resonance...
what's my default?
So you start to question those things. Hmm? You question everything. Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing. I have a practice. I have a daily practice, which people may not understand that. I call it Meet Becky, okay? Because I call my brain Becky. Yeah, so my brain is not Mo. Yeah. My brain is Becky. And so Meet Becky is a 25 minutes a day where Becky blabbers away. She just says things, okay? My brain goes like, your daughter doesn't love you. And I go like, seriously, Becky? And I write it down. And I ask what else, right? And it will go like, you're never going to close that deal. Okay, Becky, you think I'm not going to close that deal, right? And then you look at them and you question them,
okay,
right? You question them. You question them. You Islam told you to do A, B, and C. And then you go like, okay, if Islam told you to do A, B, and C, but also told you that Jesus, we call Jesus the Word of God, right? If Islam also told you that there were other prophets, how come Jesus didn't tell you to do A, B, and C? So one of those statements is not correct. It's just an analytical thinking, right? And then you start to think through those things and say, okay, so Jesus said this, Muhammad said that, and my wife said this. What do I want to say? Like, what do I feel? Okay? And when you found that, you found yourself. You found that E sound. You found that natural resonance. Okay? And when you found that natural resonance, you start to tell yourself, am I brave enough to live that natural
Well, that's resonance? Another big question, right? Because one thing is to say, okay, now I get it. This is how I feel. This is who I am. But would I be accepted that way? Would people go away if I am who I really am? Would I lose my job? And that requires courage, right?
That requires you questioning that statement. Okay, so seriously, will I be accepted if I was that way? Mm-hmm. Right? Very good question. Where did you get the idea that you're accepted now to start with? Yeah. Okay, and where did you get the idea that it's more important to be accepted than to be yourself? Where did you get the idea that if you were yourself, you're not going to be accepted? When was the last time you were actually yourself, you were fully yourself, and you were not accepted? Not accepted by who? Did that person that didn't accept you matter, or was it someone that actually didn't match you at all? Yeah. Right? So, you know, it's a series of questions. At the bottom, at the core of all of it is, but this is who I am, right? So I always share the story of my son, Ali. Ali, as I said, Ali was so wise from the day he was born. And if I remember correctly, he was 9 years of age. We were moving again because of my career. It was his 11th school. Okay. And so anyway, Ali decides that he wasn't going to be selective in friendships this time, because who cares? Anyway, we're moving again. And so a week in, he comes home from school. He says, I met this guy, George. He's nice, right? A week later, he comes home from school and says, Papa, if George calls, tell him I don't want to be his friend anymore. He's 9.
Okay.
Okay. And I said, why, Habibi? He said, yeah, it's just too much effort. Right. So Ali was that little
Zen monk. 9 years old.
Yes, listen out. Huh? Ali was that little Zen monk. George was the devil himself. Okay. I mean, not in a bad way, but George was hyperactive, destructive,
energy vampire.
Loud, energy, exactly, right? And so, you know, literally 3 minutes later, the phone rings. George is on the phone. He goes like, hey, is Ali here? And I'm like, yes, he's here, but he said he doesn't want to be your friend anymore. Like, I'm now the embarrassed one. And of course, George being George answers by saying, okay, I'm coming. Like, what? What? I just told you. Right? Anyway, he hangs up. He shows up like 20 minutes later. His mother drops him at the door and leaves. Okay. And he's just, you know, rings the bell, comes in, runs around everywhere. And I'm like, where is Ali? And I'm like, Ali said he doesn't want to be your friend. And like a dignified little Yoda, Ali starts to come downstairs very slowly saying, George, as I told you, you're a wonderful person, but I'm just not like you. Okay. Anyway, feel free to play as much as you want until your mom comes and picks you up. Anyway. So I go upstairs with Ali after a while. I go like, Ali, why? And he said, Papa, look, George is not a bad boy. It's just very different than I am. Okay. And I realized that if I'm with George, people that I like will not come and be my friends anymore. Okay. It will take me a lot of effort to be like George. I will never be good at it. Okay. And people that I like will not want to be with me anymore. So I thought it's better to stay alone until I find people that I like.
Wow.
Now, listen to the wisdom. In his view, it's not about being accepted. It's about being accepted by those that matter. Okay. He understood instinctively. By the way, no, Ali wasn't extra smart. He was just not too conditioned. I mean, he was super smart for me. Sorry, Ali. Sorry. But the idea is this. Huh? The idea is, do we want to be accepted by everyone? Which basically means we have to pretend all the time, which basically means that we are going to be not accepted anyway, because the one they will accept is the one you're pretending to be, not the one that you really are. Okay. Or do you want to say to yourself, well, look, truth is I am quiet and I am not fit with those who are jumpy and energetic. Okay. And of course, you know, this is who I am. This is how I want to be. And literally a week later, Ali meets Max. Actually he meets Jack first. Jack is still, you know, was still his best friend until the day he died.
Then right after that, he meets Nick, because Nick likes Jack and accordingly likes Ali. And then they meet Sam, and they eventually ended up being that group that everyone adored, because they were not pretending to be anything. They were just showing up, chill like hell, and everyone loved that they were, they wore their hearts on their sleeve.
But how does a kid learn that? Like, I mean, you know, because I didn't say, how do you teach him to be like that? Because I know it's, it might not be, but how do you help your kids? I have a 1-year-old kid, and I always wonder that, like, how do you make him grow into himself instead of growing into something you expect from him, right? How did you manage to make him so savvy in that way?
So you don't make a child anything. That's the trick. Okay, so there are two sides to this question, huh? Because how do you teach him things is one thing, and how do you let him become himself is another thing, right? Common among them is how you are, how you behave, and more importantly, what you define success as. Okay. So most parents believe that if my son grows to be rich and handsome and famous, then I've succeeded to raise a good son. For that, I'm going to beat the hell out of them to work hard and study too much and do this and that and the other, right? I didn't believe that. I believed that success was if I could reach a person that is impactful and efficient in life, doesn't have to be a billionaire, doesn't have to be a CEO, but happy, okay? If you make happiness, because ask yourself this question, huh? Would you prefer to have a son that is very successful but miserable? Or would you prefer to have a son that is reasonably successful and happy?
Second one.
Okay? Of course. And we forget that. So most of our actions are driving our children to be successful. Very few of our actions actually ask, would that make them happy? Right? And so if you make that your success criteria, you're going to start looking at things that don't push your children. Ali, for example, and Aya were brilliant in mathematics. They got the math genes from daddy, but they didn't want to be mathematicians. Aya wanted to be an artist, okay? And Ali, in a way, wanted to be a philosopher, wanted knowledge, wanted to understand things, okay? Now, I could have pushed them. I said, are you stupid? You guys are good. I'll tell you, I'm really good in math. I can make you really good at this, okay? I didn't. I just, when Nibel Habibti, my ex-wife, she followed society for a while. And so society in the upper middle class in the Middle East basically says you take your children from piano lessons to tennis lessons to swimming lessons to, okay? And I resisted and I said, Nibel, do they want to play tennis? Okay? And wise, she was so wise. She still is so wise. She goes like, I don't know. And I said, okay, why don't we agree the following? We'll take them to tennis lessons. If they like it, we'll keep them in tennis lessons. If they don't, we will take them away from tennis lessons. Okay? And so rather than tell them that the image of a successful child is one that is a student that plays tennis and plays the piano and does this and does that, which is stupid. To us, the image of a successful child is a child who's truly himself or herself, confident, feeling loved, and doing things that they excel at because they love doing.
Okay.
And your job, so again, in Nibel's words, in my ex-wife's words, she said, at the beginning, I thought they were my children. And then I thought there was nothing in them that is mine.
Yes.
You understand that? You don't own your children. And then she said, it seemed then that I am their parent. But then I realized I'm not supposed to be a parent. I'm supposed to be there to help them find their own selves. That's my role in life. My role in life for my children is I am there so that if they look right and go like, oh, that's interesting, I jump and get it
for them. A facilitator.
Okay? A facilitator for them to find their own selves. Okay? And if you don't believe that, look at your own self. Huh? Look at you growing up, regardless of how good or bad or difficult your parents were. And what you wanted. You were spending your whole, especially teenage life, okay? trying to be what you want to be despite their resistance. Yeah. And maybe if they just supported you, you would have gone further in being who you wanted to be, because you wouldn't have wanted to prove them wrong. You wouldn't have wanted to reinstate your independence. You wouldn't have wasted so much effort and time trying to get them convinced that you're a footballer. I like football. I want to play football, mm-hmm. right? No. Yeah. Study geography. Like, what is that? Right? And I think the trick about raising kids, if you ask me, is that your children will never do what you ask them to do. Okay? they'll always do what you do. Right? So if you're a crazy control freak like I used to be when my kids were young, they would grow up to be crazy control freaks. Other than, you know, again, my wonderful wise wife sat next to me once and said, "I love you. But I'm afraid that if the kids catch those things from you, they are not going to be happy." I'm like, "What do you mean?" And she's like, "You know, why don't you do this instead of that? It's also part of you. Like, I'm not asking you to mm-hmm. change for me. I'm just asking you in front of the kids, you know, can you do this instead of that? Don't pretend, but can you show more of this than that?" Because what was I showing? I was showing the macho Middle Eastern father image. "Do this, don't do that, I'll beat you." What mm-hmm. stupid. Who conditioned me to do this, right? And then eventually, I'll tell you, me and Nibel, we sat there doing nothing but being their servants. We were their facilitators, okay? And they not only led their own life to where they needed to be, they led our life. There is so much wisdom in us as humans that is built in. So again, in Islamic culture, we have something that basically says your brain is not in your head, mm-hmm. okay? That your brain is truly in your heart.
Okay.
And when I started, so I've been working for the last 5.5 years on a project basically that empowers the feminine side of me. So I remember, mathematician, computer scientist, mm-hmm. engineer, right? Totally left-brained. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was smart. Mm-hmm. Until I started to empower my feminine. The feminine brain has creativity. It has the ability to embrace paradoxes. It has intuition. It has empathy, which is, by the way, the highest form of intelligence. And when you combine all of that, you know, when you really, really, really manage to find your feminine and intelligence, don't tell anyone, Diego, you and I are stupid. Like, the mm-hmm. masculine brain is so limited. It's so limited. It's linear thinking. It's linear thinking. It's analytical thinking. Very valuable when you've actually consulted your intuition on what should you dedicate your linear thinking to. Right? It is problem solving.
Good for
very,
execution.
Very useful if you've managed, exactly, if you've managed to embrace a paradoxical thinking that told you, by the way, there are multiple approaches here, right? There is not one right answer. So all of those things, when you really, really allow yourself to think that way, this is when you start to make a difference to yourself, to your children, to everyone around you. And how, again, goes back to, have you ever debated what you were told?
Okay,
so
you just talked about letting your kids, for example, find themselves and do what they wish to do and try. But I wonder what happened when you were a kid. What did you know what you wanted to be when you grew up? And I ask you this because, I mean, you've learned a lot of things in university and masters and stuff. But I think that many of the things you ended up doing were always new things. Like, I think it's quite impossible for you when you were starting to know that Google X will even exist someday in the future. And like, your job constantly was about solving new things that didn't exist before, right? Like opening new areas of each company and doing stuff. So when you were a kid, what did you wanted to do when you were like an adult? And also, how did you learn to do things that didn't have a prior, like somewhere to learn from, you know, you needed to solve problems that were never there before.
I wonder if an answer to this would be not a misleading answer, to be honest. So I think at the core of understanding how our brains work is a conviction that your brain is different mm-hmm. than mine. Okay. That our audience, our listeners, each and every single one of them mm-hmm. is different. Okay. And you know, the way we learn is different. Our abilities are different, and it's so complex even though so simple, right? So if you take, you know, a person who loves mathematics, for example, by definition, they will probably be good musicians. It's the same part of the brain. An animal lover, for example, is by definition a little more creative. There is the same part, mm-hmm. side of the brain, and so on and so forth. And so the trick is to understand what your own brain is. So almost like horoscopes, where, you know, sometimes those things become really accurate descriptions of what a Gemini is, or, you know, what another horoscope is. It's basically, it requires that understanding. The thing, however, is the way our brains work is very, very much the way, similar to the way our muscles work. You know, when you go to the gym and work out, you strengthen certain muscles. Okay. Similarly, when you use your brain in specific ways repeatedly, you strengthen certain neural paths. Okay. So I interviewed on Slow Mo. I mean, one of my dear friends is Rick Hansen, who's a very well known neuroscientist, who's also a very, very devout Buddhist, and he works on that interface interface between spirituality and neuroscience, if you want. And one of Rick's big big contributions to the field is that idea of how you can train, you can sort of wire your brain for happiness. Okay, the work on neuroplasticity is a big part of that. And now what is neuroplasticity? Neuroplasticity is just like going to the gym. If you go to the gym in Europe. Mm-hmm. Most of the machines are for upper body lifting, right? And that's why the gym is mostly frequented by men, and they're all pumping iron, right? If you go to the gym in Latin America, at least the ones I went to, it's mostly frequented by women, and it's always squat mm-hmm. machines, okay? And which we totally appreciate about Latin America. Well done, right? But the truth is the following, huh? If I squatted all the time, I would look like a pear. If I lifted all the time, I would look like mm-hmm. a triangle. Now, whether a pear is better than a triangle or a triangle is better than a pear, it doesn't matter. But the truth is, what you use grows and what you don't shrinks. Okay? So you could be born a very talented artist. Okay? But then your parents will tell you, no, you shouldn't do that. You should study geography. Okay? And so what will you do? You'll study geography. So you'll do more geography and you'll do less art. The more you do geography, the slightly better you will become at geography. And the less you do art, the more those parts of your art brain will diminish. Okay. And so eventually you'll look like a pear, right? Only the parts that you've grown are not the parts that you wanted to grow. And this applies to everything. Huh? If you complain 4 times a day about your life, you'll become a very good complainer. Okay? If you learn to criticize everything that your friend tell you, you'll become a very good criticizer. Okay? If you look for everything that's wrong with everything, you'll become very good at finding what's wrong and accordingly miserable. Okay? And so on, right? And so if you constantly tell yourself the life is unfair and I'm the victim, you'll become a fantastic victim, right? And you will be more and more victimizing yourself as life continues to victimize you. Now, so my brain was the kind of brain that wanted to try a lot of things, okay? I had a mother who was an academic and a father who was an engineer, a field person. And so my mother said, as many books as you want. And by the way, any hobby that you want, I will support you. So there were times where I converted my small bedroom into a massive fish breeding aquarium setup. I had like 20 aquariums and it smelled like crap. Okay. And it was really, but I became really good at it and I traded in fish and I made a lot of money and so on and so forth. And my mother was fully supportive, right? And then there was another time where I decided I want to take up carpentry. So I had a full workshop with a massive pile of wood dust on the side. Okay. She just supported me. My dad, on the other hand, completely believed that learning happens in the real world, not academic and not inside your bedroom. So he shipped me over since I was 11. Every single summer, I had to travel for a month alone. Okay? And so I was interacting with life, like learning how to deal with people. I remember vividly the first time I went to Germany. I didn't know that Germany closes down completely, at least at the time, on Sundays. So he gave me dollars. I didn't have Deutschmarks, and I needed to go and convert money on Saturday evening so that I have, Deutschmarks at the time, and basically I was having fun and going out with friends, and I didn't do it. And I was starving to death by Sunday evening, right? Teaches you a little bit of planning that, you need to think a little bit ahead. And so between those two, should every parent do that to their children? No. Okay. Should every one of us do this to themselves? No. You need to tell yourself, am I looking for, a strong upper body, or am I looking for a curvy down body, lower body? And then choose the exercises that get you there.
Okay.
Right? And the trick is this, huh? The trick is, don't lift too heavy. Don't put 200 kilograms and do one squat. Do 10 squats, 5 sets, 4 days a week. Okay? And the same applies to your brain. Huh? You want to be happy? Learn to do something that makes you gratitude. Learn to think about the things you're grateful for every night for 3 minutes. Because that's how neuroplasticity works. It builds brain cells. It reconfigures the wiring of your brain over
Perfect.
Time.
Perfect. Mo, we're running out of time, because I don't want to keep you here more than we agreed. But I have a couple of questions still, if you would let me answer them.
Okay, anything
perfect.
You want.
So one thing would be, it has two sides to the question. The first is, how has your understanding of happiness changed since you published the book? If it has, if something has changed in your way of viewing happiness, and also, how do you avoid becoming or feeling some sort of constraint? Like, I bet people ask you when you're sad, like, how can you be sad if you wrote about happiness? Like, how do we avoid becoming that character that always has to comply with what you said before in your book? I don't know if what I'm saying makes any sense to you.
Yeah.
And do you have any answer to that?
Yeah. So let's start with the second one. I think the second one is leads us better to the first one. So if I am to win the confidence of people, in terms of trusting my word on happiness, I need to be the Olympic champion of happiness. Okay? And to be the Olympic champion of happiness requires you to exercise like an Olympic champion, right? Does that mean I'm always happy? Of course not. Now, in my definition of happiness, happiness is equal to or greater than the difference between the events of your life and your expectations of how life should be. When life misses your expectations, you're bound to feel a negative emotion. When life misses your expectation, you can feel worry, you can feel sad, you can feel regret, you can feel shame, whatever negative emotion is there, because unhappiness is a survival mechanism. It's part of our instinctive nature to detect things that are suboptimal. So your brain's primary function, believe it or not, secondary function is to invent iPhones, right? But the primary function of your brain is to detect any suboptimal situations and alert you to them so that you do something about it. Okay? So, you go home tonight, your wife says something that is a little harsh. You don't feel unhappy because of any reason other than your brain is saying, ooh, something is wrong here. I need to take action. I need to take charge of this. I need to do something about it. Now, that basically means that we're all going to feel that. As a matter of fact, it's unhealthy if you try to not feel that way, because it would be similar to you trying to, shield the pain of touching electricity. Right, the pain is a survival mechanism that gets you to move your hand away. So, I'm supposed to feel worried if someone I love is not feeling well. I'm supposed to feel that way because it's a survival mechanism. But that is pain. Mm-hmm. That is whether emotional or physical pain, they're the same. They're there for a reason. They're like the fire alarm telling you to take action. Unhappiness, on the other hand, is totally useless. So if she says something harsh, you feel unhappy, you feel worried, you feel sad, and then you take yourself up and you go to her and you say, baby, we need to talk. What you just said made me feel sad. You've used that survival mechanism to survive, to thrive, okay? But if you take it and go like, she doesn't love me anymore, right? And then you wait 3 days and then you start to say, must be because I'm getting fat. And then you wait, 2 days and you say, oh, she's never going to love me again. Okay. And then you wait 2 days and say, I'm going to be without her. I hate dating. I'm going to spend the rest of my life alone. Right. All of that. You can keep building. You can keep building the drama. It's almost like YouTube of unhappiness. Okay. It's like, remember that little video we saw last Friday? Let's play that again. And let's play it again. And let's add a little bit to it and let's make it horrible. That is what I practice. Okay. So my practice is not trying to numb my ability to feel unhappy. It's useful to feel every emotion. It's wonderful to feel every emotion. It's what makes us alive. My practice is how quickly do I recognize that feeling and how quickly do I go through what I call my happiness flow chart and bounce back to happiness. Bouncing back to happiness is what matters. And I say that publicly, and I'm not bragging. But with years of practice, my average bounce back time from the second I feel unhappy to the second I feel I have gone through the thinking and dismissed the unhappiness is on average 7 seconds. Okay? And it's not, I'm not, this is Olympic champion level. Okay? But it's not difficult at all. It's actually quite logical. Most of the things that make us unhappy are not worth the unhappiness, and they are calling for an action. So take the action. It's as simple as that. I can go into it in details, but maybe in another time, right? But so bouncing back to happiness. So of course, there are times. You know, this year so far, I had 3 situations where one took me 4 hours and 2 took me 1 day each to bounce back to happiness. Fair, okay. You know, next year I'll do better. But the idea here is how do we bounce back to happiness? How do we go from that feeling of unhappiness to happiness? And don't pretend. Pretending that you're happy all the time, this is toxic positivity. Okay? It's not supposed to be there. You're supposed to feel and supposed to deal with what you feel. So this was your first question. Or your second question. What was the first one?
That if your understanding of happiness has changed after the book.
Oh, yes, yes. So I again, part of being the Olympic champion has been the 80,000, you know, people I interact with, many more actually on social media. And I pay a lot of attention. Okay. And I learned that we are, from a design point of view, like cars are all more or less the same. Internal combustion engine cars or electric cars are more or less the same. Huh? We all operate on the same engineering principles, but we design, we end up being designed differently. So an Audi is different than a Toyota in many ways. Okay. The happiness equation applies to all of us exactly the same way. The 6 grand illusions apply to all of us exactly the same way. But there is conditioning in us that makes some of us deal with those things differently, filter them differently, you know, have biases about them. So you guys in Latin America, right, you know, would puzzle any capitalist American businessman in New York like crazy. It's like, you know, you remember that that joke about the fisherman that fishes enough and then goes to spend time with his family. You know, the capitalist would say, why are you not working a little more so you can buy a few more boats and so on and so forth, right? And then the fisherman asks, so why would I do that? And the capitalist would say, you know, so that you can actually finish your work early and go spend time with your family. And the capitalist and the fisherman would say, yeah, I'm doing that already, okay? And so, in Latin culture, we believe that family matters. We believe that our relationships with friends and our love life and dancing and enjoying life is a big part of the Latin culture. That is a very good way to solve your happiness equation, right? In German or Northern European culture, there is that debate and criticism. And, you know, in Eastern European culture, there is that cynicism, looking for what's wrong, always looking for what's wrong, and, you know, and so on and so forth, right? The machine works exactly the same way, but the way you use the equation differs from country to country. Okay. More or less at the end of the day, I will narrow it down to the mission, really, to 1 billion happy. Huh? I believe that people are happy when they make happiness their priority. Okay. That when they shoot where they aim for happiness and make it more important than other things. Then when they practice happiness, like they go to the gym. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then when they try to make others happy.
Okay.
Right. So if you look at happy cultures around the world, these are the three primary guidelines. People value their happiness, so they'll go dancing even though they may not have had a job for tomorrow. Okay. They will practice happiness. They will do things that make them happy, be with people that make them happy, not with people that make them rich, or not necessarily. I mean, sadly, of course, the big cosmopolitan cities, even in Latin America now, are becoming more like America. And third is, they will want to make others happy. And if we want to make others happy, this is my 1 billion happy mission. If you want to make others happy, just go leave this conversation. If it made you any happier, call a couple of friends and tell them, hey, by the way, I learned something new today, right? And that's your attempt to make others happy. And if two of us tell two, who will tell two, who will tell two, who will tell two each, we'll get to a billion happy in no time.
Perfect. Mo, one last thing. We started with the word lucky, and you told me you had an interesting definition of that, and I would like to listen to that before we close this up.
So I work on multiple books at the same time. One of the books I'm working on is a book that I call Understanding Fate. Okay. And you know, I wanted to understand the impact of luck on fate. Mm-hmm. And so I did an experiment. And in that experiment, I went out looking for US dollar cents, the copper looking ones, bronze looking ones. And within 3 weeks, understand, before that, I never found a US dollar cent. Okay. Within 3 weeks from starting that experiment, I found 137 of them. Okay. I found 137 of them in the weirdest places, in the streets of New York, as you can expect, but also in India, in Dubai airport, in Heathrow airport, everywhere. Okay. I found them when you count it, I found several of them a day at sometimes. And so I expanded the experience and I said, how stupid, why didn't I look for something more valuable? Let me look for jewelry. Okay. And I remember vividly, around a week into that experiment, I found more accessories. None of them were actually gold, other than that one thing, which looked like a diamond ring. Okay. That was, again, on the streets of New York, in a very busy street in New York, in Broadway. And I basically, instead of picking it up, I stood on the wall, rested on the wall and watched as 70 people walked over it, okay, and never even noticed it, never even picked it up, right? And I started to do the math in my mind. Huh? From a probability point of view, I had no higher probability of coming across that thing than any of them, okay? Because basically any one of them could have seen it with the exact same probability that I could. Hmm? But I was looking for it. I was looking for it. I was expecting it. I was expecting life to send me accessories and jewelry. So I was primed. So I could see it. And that really is what your luck is about. Hmm? It's that interesting tendency to believe that there is something for you to find. Is that serendipity of allowing yourself, for example, if I was looking for US dollar cents and I decided to lock myself in my room for 3 weeks, I would have found none. It's that openness to find it, is that interest to find it, is that optimism to find it, but it's also the serendipity of being out there in the world. And so, you know, let's close with this. COVID-19 hits and everyone in the world starts to talk about the negative side of it. Right? Because of my brain training around what luck is, I was like, there must be something good about it. There must be something good about it. Okay. So I started to list down what good can come out of it. You know, one of the examples that is completely fundamental to my life now, I don't know how I would live without it, is COVID-19 starts, I decide to start my slow-mo podcast, right? I go like, people need positivity, okay? So I say, let me give it a try. And today it's one of the top 10% worldwide. It's making a difference to thousands of people. And it's the best joy of my day. Like the 2 hours I spend with my guests to record a podcast is just so enjoyable, so much wisdom. I could have chosen COVID-19 as the opportunity to shut down and cry. Okay. And I could choose it as an opportunity to try and start Slow-Mo, a beautiful project. The difference between them is an optimism, is an idea of I can make my own luck. I can actually go out there and choose the good side of life. And if I do that, then I may not be luckier, guaranteed, but from a probability point of view, I'm much more likely to find the diamond ring if I'm expecting life to give me the diamond ring. And I think that's what luck is really all about.
Thank you everyone for listening to a new episode of The Mentes. My name is Diego Barrazas and we'll watch each other on the next episode. So see you, have a great, great week. Bye.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.